Welcome to Money, Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment and strategic decision making. If you're a fund selector or an independent financial advisor or an institutional capitalist looking for insights, analysis and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uester. In today's episode, we'll be diving into a topic that might not be the most exciting, but remains crucial for every one of us, the importance of having a will, but also the challenges of obtaining a valid one. The COVID-19 pandemic certainly made many South Africans rethink their priorities, and for a lot of people, it highlighted just how important it is to have their affairs in order. But as it turns out, more than two-thirds of South Africans still don't have a will, according to the latest statistics. So with it being the Law Society's annual Wills Month of September, of course, I thought it appropriate to explore why that is the case and what the challenges are when it comes to creating a valid will under South African law. In studio today to help me and my listeners to better understand all this is Chris Murphy, the Vice Chairperson of the Fiduciary Institute of Southern Africa, or FISA for short, as well as Founder Director of Legacy Fiduciary Services and Estate Planners. Chris is a Registered Fiduciary Practitioner of South Africa and an Authorized Trust and Estate Practitioner. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Ruan. Welcome to all the listeners.
Chris, let's start with the basics. A will is essentially a legal document that outlines how assets will be distributed after death. If you don't have one, your estate will be distributed according to the Interstate Succession Act, which may not reflect one's wishes, or even worse, leave one's financial legacy as a ward of the state. It is easy enough to get one, as I've come to realize. You can buy a template from a stationery shop or even download a copy from the web. But the problem is that things can get complicated if its validity is questioned. So what are the legal requirements for a valid will in South Africa?
Well, the simple form is it could be a simple one-page document. It must be written on paper, signed in ink or black pen, and witnessed by two independent individuals, both over the age of 14 and of sound mind. And obviously, they cannot be related to the testator, the person signing the will, and best not have any influence over that person.
As easy as that. But there's another thing. The Wills Act was written long before the digital age. And so despite how far technology has come, digital wills are not legally recognized in South Africa. Why is that? And what are some of the biggest problems around this fact that were exposed during the hard lockdown of the pandemic?
That's where things got tricky during the pandemic. In a time when physical distancing was a necessity and lockdowns restricted our movement, the requirement to have the witnesses physically present, because the witnesses who witness the will must be at the same place at the same time as the person signing the will. So it made it almost impossible for many people to draft or update their wills. It was tricky because, you know, we were all locked down in our own house. We couldn't find independent witnesses. We were stressing, had to sign some document. And for many years, we've been trying as an industry to try and get amendments. But I can tell you that the reality is because of unfortunate dramatic fraud that does happen around wills being signed and drafted, et cetera, we still have to revert back to the original Act of 1953, which was only amended in 1992, which gives a clear critical details as to what must be done. So there isn't anything current or new which allows us to do anything other than a handwritten by the testator or a typed document signed by the testator before two witnesses.
Well, Chris, that brings me to this important question. Should South Africa's laws be updated to allow for digital wills? And what other laws linked to the process of estate planning do you think needs to be reviewed as well in this context?
So experts certainly think so, but current law aims to prevent fraud, duress and undue influence. They believe the process could be modernized, and we do think it could be modernized by the introduction of some form of digital execution, whether by video, online, a competent person watching the will being signed, etc., and witnesses being in different jurisdictions, but on the same camera or the same Teams meeting. But the whatever digital system is included, it would have to include safeguards such as witnessing viewing the signing via video conference to ensure it meets the legal standards. Because unfortunately, fraud is what we have to guard against on every level.
Chris, how do we compare with global best practice or the way they do things abroad?
So every jurisdiction is very different. Some states in America, for example, allow a video will, which is not something that we allow for here. So we're comparable with many of the European jurisdictions. Some of the older jurisdictions still require wills to be signed before notaries, as an example, in France or Switzerland, etc. So we're not that far behind. But if you think of other advances in technology, I use SARS as an example, where to get registered as a taxpayer these days, you have to use a selfie. Who would have thought that selfies of yourself with your ID next to you is something that could be used? But there are other ways of showing who you are.
Well, let's get back to the digital age. With the rise of digital assets and social media accounts, how should individuals approach these digital estate planning mitigating factors? And what specific steps can they take to manage their digital legacy effectively?
So the question is, what are the digital assets and what value, if any, is attributable to them? Many people think that when you talk about a digital asset, you may be talking about Bitcoin or some sort of financial investment. Other persons may think, well, we're talking about personal web pages, your YouTube channel, and things like that, and banking profiles. So it's critical that you establish what you need to look after, protect, and give access to the documents that are required to access those to your loved ones on your passing. So even with a will in place, we can be locked out of digital assets suddenly, which could cause undue distress, especially if the link for payment of monthly expenses or access to liquidity, etc. But more importantly, when you have issues such as passwords and PINs, social media and digital accounts, I'm sure many of us have seen posts on, for example, Facebook, where people are posting on deceased members' bank accounts and profiles, and somebody happens to respond as the deceased. It can cause quite shock and horror on the part of the friends. So there is talk of what is called a digital executor. And what that means is, obviously, in a will, you have an executor, which winds up your estate and the point that will deal with it. But you can have a digital executor. The problem with having a digital executor is the way that all these accounts with passwords, how they evolve over time. It's not simply going to your trusted friend or family member and saying, look, these are all the passwords. If something happens, this is what you must do. Because passwords, by their nature, are updated regularly, you can't, what happens if your password is updated on the Monday, you forgot to tell your family member, and on the Wednesday you pass away, it's all gone to nothing. So you've got to, there are programs, there are programs out there that have digital password protection, which update and prompt, and you can have co-signatories on those accounts. So for example, you and your executor, so every time there's a change to a password, it will update. And that probably is going to be the way of the future. We're not getting anywhere quickly with the digital wills, but we need to get somewhere with regard to your online profiles and your online assets.
Chris, something that I picked up quite extensively during the COVID pandemic and the period after is people who had a will and paper did everything they should in the right way, had their paperwork filed with a loved one or locked up in their safe. But when they passed away, nobody could find it, or their house burned down and the only copy was destroyed, or any kind of similar weird circumstance. What is your advice to people like that? Because we have to have it in paper to make sure that if something like that happens, you do have a backup plan.
So remember, the weird thing about wills is that you can only have one will. There's only one original document. What I mean is, if you have two copies of the same document and you sign them both as an original, by operational law, only one of them could be an original. But saying that, if a digital copy is available, remember that in terms of Section 2A of the Wills, 2 capital A of the Wills Act, an application may be made to the High Court, not the Master of the High Court, but the High Court as in a judge, to have whatever you've got deemed to be included as your original will or your last direction, and the court has that power. So in the past, where we've had situations where the actual original is destroyed or misplaced, as long as you can confirm that there is no reasonable doubt that the testator, being the person who did the will, destroyed it themselves, you can make application to court to have the document, the will, the page. The court will dictate that can be acceptable as the original will. So there are options. The problem is that it's costly. It's costly, number one, and it takes time. And the reality is, it's not that you want your will or your document to stand up in court. It's that you don't want to have to go to court. So, there are solutions. They're not simple. They're not quick, and they're costly. But you can, in circumstances, that was the amendment to the Wills Act, which allows the court to make a direction.
Chris, as a final question, and this is something that I've been struggling to get my mind around, is around estate duty and the assets that fall outside of the scope of deceased estates in terms of law. Some pension funds do, some insurance policies don't. Perhaps you can take us through just a few examples of inclusions or exclusions in this regard, which is not as well known, and it should be, by financial planners that are not necessarily estate planning experts.
No problem. So the first thing to remember is quite simple. Anything and everything that goes to a spouse in terms of a will is exempt from estate duty, and there is no capital gains tax at the death of the first spouse if the surviving spouse inherits everything. It's not exempt. Capital gains tax isn't an exemption, but it's a rollover. So you wouldn't pay at the first dying's estate. So if you park that, whatever goes to the spouse is exempt. Whatever goes to the spouse is also delayed from a capital gains tax perspective. Over and above that, if you have living annuities or retirement annuities which have a beneficiary nomination, obviously if it's the spouse, then it's a full exemption. If it doesn't go to a spouse but goes to a nominated beneficiary, then the general rule is that is outside of your estate. And as it's outside of your estate, it doesn't fall subject to executor's fees or estate duty. The one that is the tricky one, which people forget about, is life policies. For example, if you've got a life policy that pays 100,000 rand to the spouse, exempt because it goes to the spouse. If you've got a life policy that pays 100,000 rand to the son, that doesn't fall into the estate for executor's fees, but it does fall into the estate for estate duty calculation as a deemed asset. So something that isn't dealt with in the wonderful document called the liquidation and distribution account in the estate, it may not fall in there, but it'll fall into the estate duty return. They're two separate sets of accounts. The estate duty return deals with estate duty payable on assets that are in the estate and on any assets that can be regarded as being deemed assets. So something that's deemed for tax purposes, like a life policy, like a usufruct ceasing, or like interest. So I don't want to get too technical, but the bottom line is, even if the spouse is exempt, if it doesn't go to the spouse and there's a policy that falls outside of the estate for executor's fees, but it goes to a beneficiary, be careful, because the beneficiary gets paid that money directly from the insurance company. And there may or may not be a deemed asset component. So that asset, if it's 100,000 rand, for example, if it's subject to the estate duty computation, they make off with 100,000 rand, but they owe the executor and the estate 20% of that to pay to SARS. And sometimes people forget that.
So it is best to get expert advice on all these technicalities. Well, that wraps up our episode today, and I leave you with this. If you don't yet have a will, now is the time to get one in place. And speaking to a financial advisor is a good place to start. Not just to avoid any legal pitfalls we've discussed today, but to ensure that your loved ones are taken care of and that your wishes are respected. A big thank you to our guest, Chris Murphy, for sharing his expertise and experiences with us today. Your insights have been incredibly valuable. To all our CityWire South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money, Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uester, and my producer, Vera Loba da Silva, from the CityWire Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We are available on all major platforms such as Spotify and Apple Podcasts, as well as iono.fm. All CityWire South Africa's podcasts and videos are also on its website. Please go register and have a look at our wealth of multimedia content. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.